Tropical Gardener presents Shauna and Dorothy Doby, the editor and publisher of Canada's Local Gardener magazine, are here for you.
Hello, welcome to Canada's Local Gardener podcast. I'm Shauna Doby. I'm here with my mother, Dorothy, and we're going to talk today to Stephanie Rose of a lot of things, but most recently, the writer of The Regenerative Garden. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi, Shauna. Hi, Dorothy. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Stephanie. And Stephanie, I just want to remind folks that we had the pleasure of visiting your garden last summer, and it was beautiful and very creative.
Yeah, it was so fun to have you there. It was a really, really hot day, and we had a chance to tour. It was hot and sunny in the middle of the day, and we had a chance to tour around the garden, sort of look at the projects that I was working on for the regenerative garden. And then we sat down, and we had a butterfly pea flower iced tea, which is that wonderful blue, that herbal, like natural blue color that you get from butterfly pea flowers. And then you add a little acid to it and it turns purple. So we had a lot of fun with that.
Well, Shauna was absolutely boggled by that. I think that was the highlight for her. Anyway.
And I have to say, I always get a little bit excited because I've been doing this for a few years when I come across something new. I mean, not that old stuff isn't important, and it is, and I value it and love it, but that was quite new to me. I had never seen it before. And in looking over your book, there are a number of things that are very new to me, including the Ola water catchment system, the companion planting guide. I love the way you did that. The guilds, the hurdles. Where do you learn all this stuff, Stephanie?
You know, I'm so glad you said that, Shauna, because really, I come to gardening from a perspective of somebody who was trying to make gardening a lot easier for myself. As you know a little bit about my story, I became severely disabled back in 2006, and I had to find a way to heal while I was stuck in my house. And so I turned to gardening. I got every book from the library. I started reading through them, learning how to garden, how, you know, sort of we've been taught in more modern times to garden, clear out the land, put in raised beds, plant things in rows. And it was very, very time consuming. Mm-hmm. It took a lot of effort, you know, to maintain the garden took a lot of work. And so I thought, you know, like there has to be a better way. I spent a lot of time sitting in my beautiful hammock chair, which you saw, swinging and just sort of looking at the garden and being peaceful. And I thought, why are we not following the path of nature? And that kind of led me, I kind of started going down the path. So as I trained as a gardener over the years and I became a master gardener, and then I, you know, joined a community garden, started a charity garden, all these sorts of things, it was pure gardening. I found permaculture and herbalism. And so I took those concepts that, you know, can seem a little out there sometimes, but really it's using plants as medicine, and understanding how plants sort of repair our earth and how they work together with us as humans and all the flora and fauna that we share the space with. And I took those concepts and brought it together in this book, The Regenerative Garden, so that it allows people who are gardening right now a way to follow the path of nature. So it takes those really uses all the super smart science of nature and how nature does it anyway, like in a forest or a meadow, and takes those and makes it so that it is a lot easier, takes a less time, costs a lot less money. And so that's why it looks a little bit different, because in a permaculture setting, a lot of these projects are quite common. And for herbalists, a lot of these concepts of using plants as medicine is quite common. However, as gardeners, we've been working too hard and it's time to stop.
I can remember when we started Ontario Gardener and I put in my first garden, maybe it was before we started the gardener, I'm not sure, around the year 2000. I put in a new garden at the front, and it wasn't very big, but I remember digging up all the sod and doing all that and thinking there's got to be a better way than this. And I didn't dig down or anything because, you know, there was a tree and there were roots. And so thank goodness. I don't know if anybody still digs to get a new garden, do they?
They do, especially wow. new gardeners, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so somebody, and there's been so many new gardeners over mm-hmm. this last
yes,
couple of
there
years.
Really has. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I mean, the thing is with experience, we start to go, okay, we're taught to do it this way. You know, we need to remove the grass mm-hmm. in order to create a garden bed. And removing things is so much effort and so much waste when right. we can use that wonderful turf grass as a slow release nitrogen source that's going to, mm-hmm. you know, compost down underneath our garden beds and be able to, you know, feed the soil underneath, plus create that bulk that we need instead of trucking mm-hmm. in a whole bunch of new soil. Right.
Right. So that's right. And you know, at that time, not long after I started that garden, I found a number of people saying, well, you don't have to dig. All you have to do is turn the sod over.
Yes.
And
exactly.
now, you know, you don't even have to do that. You know, you just have to put enough on it to smother what's there.
Yes.
And allow it to compost itself.
Yes, exactly. Well, so in the book, I've got, you know, instructions on how to sheet mulch and sort mm-hmm. of in the book, I have a series of, it's a honeycomb level, and I talk mm-hmm. about good, better, and best. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that we don't have to do everything perfectly right away, but if we can start with anything, it helps to move us in the right direction, and it's going to reduce the time and effort that we're spending gardening, but it's also going to be a more regenerative system. Mm-hmm. So the idea of a regenerative system, a regenerative garden, is one that grows on its own without so much human input. We can walk away from it for 10 years and come back and it will be thriving. So when we look at things like that, I've got sheet mulching in there mm-hmm. and the good, better, and best different stages of it. So,
right.
and I hesitate to use the word best because it really is that it sort of lends for people trying to reach a goal. The idea is that anything you can do is good. And exactly. if you want to do a little bit more, it's better. And then even better to do, mm-hmm. you know, the idea of sort of the gold standard is what I threw in there so that people can find their own path. Mm-hmm. So with sheet mulching, as the good is to, you know, leave your sod where it is, put some carbon source on top of there, put some mulch on top, let that sit for, you know, depending on what season it is, and you can start planting right into it once it mm-hmm. starts to compost. You know, better is to create some layers. You can actually create a more lasagna garden or a layered system. Mm-hmm. And even better would be to then add some biodynamic plants that are helping to break down the soil and add in more nutrition to it. So, mm-hmm. you know, these are different ways that we can take it. Not a lot of effort. You don't have to dig up all that sod and turn it over. But think about if you've got a patch that's not just turf grass, it's weedy and mm-hmm. full of plants that you're terrified are just going to grow up through it. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a whole section in there about how these weeds are wild plants that are fixing our soil and how we can use them in order to create better, healthier soils for us to plant our gardens in.
True enough. Now I've got a, can you really use bindweed? I mean, it will use you eventually.
Yeah, I know. So everybody has their one that they read in the book and they're like, that woman's crazy.
And my bindweed is
in... That woman's nuts. She's telling me to keep my weeds in my garden and I've been fighting this weed forever. But I guess it's more of a getting to know your wild plants mm-hmm. and understanding what it is that they're doing. So bindweed, yes. It, you know, as absolutely insanely hard as it is to get out, that's mm-hmm. because those roots are digging way down in the soil and they're breaking up hard pan soil, they're mining for deep minerals and bringing it out into the leaves and composting it. They're really doing this job of moving minerals around and mm-hmm. and adding aeration into the soil, adding organic matter as the roots die back. So yes, it's a very, very difficult plant to remove, but at the same time, it's really hard to break up that hard pan soil.
I've got to say, there is no hard pan. I don't think you'd have to go very, very deep in my front yard. It is so, it's been cultivated for a long time. It was partially dug up when we dug out our basement, and the bindweed just, I won't argue with you. The bindweed just thrives. I just,
That's the job of wild plants, right? Is to thrive. I'm not saying that they're only going to, that wild plants are only going to plant themselves in hard pan soil or that poorly nutritious soil. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that that's where their benefit really comes from in helping mm-hmm. us work in our gardens. And yes, you just keep pulling it. I mean, that's the thing about wild plants is I plant comfrey in my garden. People think I'm crazy, but you know, it's such a great compost herb. It's so nutritious. I make a comfrey smoothie that I pour into the garden. And, but you know, like when it comes time to take control of it, like I planted in a place and obviously near the compost bin because it's a great place to grab some leaves and toss them in there. Mm-hmm. But when it comes time to take care of it, like I just dig the whole thing out, toss it away, and it comes right back. So, mm-hmm. you know, you can just be harder with it. I mean, obviously you're trying to get rid of your bindweed because it's not adding value, but yeah, it just means continuously pulling, but also respecting the fact that, you know, without this in areas that aren't cultivated, it's doing us some wonderful things, and we can use them.
In all honesty, when before I started gardening, I thought bindweed was very charming.
Yeah, it's very beautiful.
It is. I mean, I like morning glories, and I thought, oh, is this a kind? It's like a kind of morning glory, and as it turns out, it is.
Yes, and it's a wonderful food source for our animals, and you know, there's lots of great things. It's, you know, mm-hmm. beautiful. It can cover up a really ugly fence very quickly. Mm. Think of those ugly chain link fences and how nice they look, covered in beautiful white blooming flowers that are scented. And
they just keep on blooming.
And they just keep on blooming. And
throwing out those seeds.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to ask you about, do you have a Hugel culture bed?
I do.
Don't remember. Yeah? Yes. Yes. And how do you okay, so this is the opposite at the beginning of do nothing, plant it, you know, mulch it, and it'll grow. For this, you have to dig down. Or do you dig down, or can you just put the logs over top?
Yeah, so Hugel culture is a really, really wonderful system that it's great for starting new beds. A lot of people will, especially farms, will, you know, do, you know, great big spots of Hugel cultures mm-hmm. because they hold water. They are very nutritious and they build soil as you grow in them. So the idea is you dig a trench and then you fill that trench with rotting wood. So start with, you know, big logs that are starting to decompose, mm-hmm. You know, the sort of like more crumbly, the better, mm-hmm. but really, you know, any sort of larger pieces of wood you have will start to decompose, and you fill that into that trench. And then around that, some smaller branches, some, you know, stone fruit pits, things that are a little bit harder to decompose that won't sort of break down in your compost as easily, and put those around. And then some carbon sources. So some dried leaves, paper, cardboard, you know, dried flower heads that aren't, you know, like hydrangeas or mm-hmm. whatever, and sort of pack that all around inside there. And then we're going to start, and then you're going to create a bit of a mound mm-hmm. and you'll cover that with a layer of compost. Then you can put in some manures or some green manures. Again, the layers that you choose are all part of the good, better, best. So it's mm-hmm. like, how much depth do you want to create? But ideally you just want to do it like you would a composting system. So you want to have your carbon source and you want to have your nitrogen source, your greens and your browns. Mm-hmm. And then you have got a layer of compost on the very top, which you'll use as your topsoil, and then you can plant right into that. So what that Hugel culture does is it creates a hill, and as the wood underneath starts to decompose over time, it compresses and becomes flat. But that wood also holds moisture. It creates a lot of airspace for airflow. It increases the fungal and bacterial, like mm-hmm. good fungus, good bacteria that we want in that soil. So it really creates a very healthy and lively soil. Mm-hmm. And compost slowly over time.
And the work you put in at the front end becomes work you save
absolutely
throughout the life of the Hugel bed.
Yes. And so it's sort of like a little bit of difference from sheet mulching, but the benefit to it is that if you have a lot of large wood, large woody material that you want to utilize and compost, and also if you want to really reduce watering, you know, so like I said, those big logs act like sponges and just hold, it's like having, I think they sell things at some garden centers. I've seen them, or people have suggested, like in your hanging baskets, you put a diaper in there, or like they have a sponge that holds onto water. Yeah. Wood is that. You don't need to go and buy an artificial material to add into your containers. Just like grab some nice pieces of wood and put them into your hanging baskets, and they will hold on to that moisture just like a little sponge.
I hadn't ever thought of doing that, putting wood into your hanging basket.
Yeah, anything that you can do to just, well, I mean, people do it with adding peat moss or coconut core into their hanging basket mix, and it does it to the same thing. It's sort of like, you know, this material that's sort of very spongy and holds on to water quite well, so that you can reduce watering. But yeah, like chunks of wood, just think of like in the forest when you go through, I mean, I live in Vancouver, BC, Canada. So we go into these big giant forests, and and the wood is just decomposing and sort of falling apart, almost like wood chips. And that wood is really, really wonderful for, you know, slowly decomposing, adding that fungal matter, adding some, you know, great bacteria, but then holding moisture as well.
Right. Wow. Let me ask you about, the Ola water catchment system. I had never heard of this before, and you've gone into some depth to explain how it works.
Yes, absolutely. So OYAs are it's Spanish.
Oh, OYA, sorry.
Yes, it comes from Spanish. So the double L's is pronounced like a Y. And that is typically a clay, like an earthen clay pot with a narrow top and sort of a wide bottom. And those are often, you know, in history used as cooking vessels, but they, in the garden, if you bury a clay pot with just the small opening at the top, above the soil line, and have the expanse of the rest of the vessel underneath the soil in a porous clay and fill it with water, then the soil will wick the water through the clay and slowly absorb it as it needs it. So it's just it's like a slow watering system. It's like a drip watering system. And you can make them at home really easily, as I show in the book, by taking two unglazed terracotta pots and sealing them together. So putting the two rims, the widest parts together, sealing them together. If you have one that doesn't have a drainage hole in the bottom, then use that. If not, you can cover it up. I just cover it up with a coin because you can use a little silicone sealer and a coin. And then the top part still has the drainage hole in it, and that would be your hole to fill. And I just bury those in my containers, or you can see them in the book in my long beds. I have 20 feet long beds, and I put two in those, you know, and it goes about 5 feet in or 7 feet in, put one and then put another one and fill those up. I put a glazed plant saucer or plant tray, you know, the ones that come with the terracotta pots on the top to keep things from flying inside of it, and keep it evaporating through the hole, keep it from the water from evaporating through the hole. And then I can really reduce my watering. So it just slowly drips out into the soil. And it's really great for things that are quite thirsty in the garden that you don't want to water a lot. So if you put it next to, like, for example, a squash plant, as the squash is doing, like, it's big sizing up and, you know, you're watering the garden, this is going to give consistent moisture. Or seedlings that, you know, need a little bit of consistent moisture. So, and it's funny when you take these apart, you'll often see the roots of the plants have now, like, decided to hug the Oya. They love them. They're like, thank you so much for this moisture. I'm going to give it a hug.
So does the moisture, the water come from, do you refill it yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. And I have, you know, again, I'm going to say the good, better and best. I mean, of course you can go and just fill it up with a watering can and let it drip, especially if you got like a lovely container garden on your deck, you know. I've got a system set up where I have a rain barrel attached to a solar system, and that has drippers that go right into the holes of the Oya. So what happens is when the sun, is a little bit brighter, it fills up the Oyas a bit more. And when the sun is a little bit dimmer, it fills them up less because the drip system is all operated by how much sun there is. So it's really a very smart system. The rain barrel fills up. As long as my rain barrel is filled up, then my Oyas are filled up.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
I know, but that's, you don't have to do it that way. You can fill them up with a watering can, and you can have just one on a container that you don't want to water so much. And it will like go away on vacation. You don't have to worry about that one dying. You know, you can just fill it up and let it slow drip release.
Wow. Okay. We're going to take a little break and we'll be back right after this message.
Every issue of Canada's Local Gardener magazine is a valuable resource that you'll want to hang on to for years to come. We'll help you explore the mysteries of the garden so that you can get more out of it. Subscribe to Canada's Local Gardener and get growing with us. Visit localgardener.net.
Stephanie Rose is with us today, and we're talking about your book, The Regenerative Gardener. Regenerative Gardener or Garden?
Regenerative Garden.
Garden. Sorry, pardon me. The Regenerative Garden. And tell me about hurdles.
Because we all have hurdles in our lives, don't we?
Right.
We need to leap over. it's so funny. I could go in so many different directions with this, but I know the thing that you're talking about is a small windbreak. So this is something that I saw from a friend of mine, Tanya Anderson, who has a website called Lovely Greens, and she's written a great book called The Woman's Garden. And she in the Isle of Man had shared a little story about the history of hurdles. So they're small woven, so usually with willow branches, woven barriers that you can put in front of individual crops or plants in order to prevent wind from either pollinating or, you know, sort of disrupting the plant as it's growing through a certain growth cycle. And these were often used by farmers in the Manx area where Tanya is from. And I used it as an example, just, you know, a quick little story about these hurdles in order to discuss, it's in the climate section, in order to discuss the idea of sort of preventing or redirecting energy. So in the climate chapter is not, you might think that the climate chapter is all about sort of dealing with our changing climate, but instead it's about looking at your individual garden and understanding how the climate affects it, and then being able to harness the energy or control the energy or redirect the energy of your small space. And it might be a larger space. You might have a larger garden, or you might have a homestead, but I've showed more pictures in that whole area of how to redirect energy. So a hurdle is a really small concept of being able to act as a windbreak. And what they say, or what the science is around windbreaks, is that for every foot of height, you get five times that in wind protection. Beyond,
you mean
it.
Five times that in the distance from the original, the hurdle?
Exactly. So for example, if you have a 1 foot hurdle, you get 5 feet of wind protection. So if you have a 5 foot fence, then you get 25 feet of wind protection. If you have a 20 foot bank of trees on the very edge of your property, then you've got a lot of wind protection for your larger property. And so that's sort of the concept there, is that you can create little bits of structure like this. You can do it through plant material, like shrubs or trees, or you can do it through fences or hurdles, all in the way to sort of harness the harness the energy, direct it in the places that you want, and create comfort in the places where you don't.
Mm-hmm. That's a great idea. I don't know how to put it differently. It's something that we overlook all the time, isn't it? People will say, "Oh, my garden is too windy," or "You can't do that in Saskatchewan because it's too windy. You know, the wind comes sweeping down the open plain. Close the plain."
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it doesn't really take that much. There's a wonderful picture that I took at Moss Mountain Farm, which is P. Allen Smith's farm mm-hmm. in Little Rock, Arkansas, that has a really large bank of oak trees on the very edge of his property. And then probably, you know, a hundred feet from that bank of trees, there is a little fire pit with two Adirondack chairs and, mm-hmm. the area where they would sit and have fire. So it's a very, very windy area. And yet that bank of trees creates this whole plane of a more comforting, less windy system mm-hmm. That allows even to have this little fire pit going.
Right. And those are things we don't always think of. Well, maybe other people do. I know that, you know, the prairie is full of shelter belts and they quit planting them for a while and they've restarted in Saskatchewan at any rate, in Manitoba. I think they always have them. But shelter belts are rows of trees that prevent the wind from primarily, I guess, blowing away the soil. But yeah. It does more than that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And creating, so as you speak of this, it reminds me of, I wrote about this as well, and there's a lot more information available through some of the links and resources that I have in the book. But I'm in wildfire country. So here mm-hmm. in Vancouver, in British Columbia, you know, we have a lot of, obviously one of our major environmental concerns right now is wildfires. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of fire resistant plants that you can plant on the outskirts of your property. So these are some things to now take into consideration. If you're, mm-hmm. you know, building your regenerative garden, what things can we plant around that are going to, you know, how can we build the system so that we're protecting our properties and our homes and from spreading wildfires.
Right.
So there's a whole list of fire resistant plants, not in the book, but I have links to where you can get those because there's wonderful resources now out for people who want to look at fire resistance when it comes mm-hmm. to planting.
Yeah, I've looked at that. It's about a year since I looked at that. And I can remember mm-hmm. there were certain trees, but I can't remember which of them that I was just fascinated that. How do you mean that doesn't really burn?
Yeah, well, I don't think it means it doesn't really burn, but it
No, but that's what they're referring to, you know?
Yeah.
The fact that it's fire retardant resistant.
Yeah, I think it's just slowing there's so many different levels in mm-hmm. that guide that teach us how, and there's so much they are also learning about plants and fire resistance, but some of it, it's not just, it's not that they don't burn, it's that they can help to slow the burn or they can help to control it. So mm-hmm. definitely different uses and worth its own research and planning.
Hmm. Okay. Tell me about, the first time I ever saw a spiral garden was probably 2008. And I went to this and I was just fascinated. I went to this one place in Ontario and they were Sempervivum hens and chicks collectors. And if you're not familiar with it, you may not realize that there are more than just two or three different types of hens and chicks. And they had maybe 100 hens and chicks and Jovi Barba. And so to be able to see them, the fellow had built a spiral. And I don't know if he had heard about it somewhere else or if he just did it, but it's a great idea. And I often thought of it, but you make the case for it being, what I'm talking about is a spiral that goes up and you plant in it as it goes down. You make the case for it being useful in addition to being beautiful.
Yes, absolutely. And again, that's in the climate chapter. That's about us harnessing the energy. And so perfect to plant a succulent type plant in mm-hmm. one of those, because if you do it in stone, so generally it comes from herb spirals, which are you know, that they're not a new thing. And it starts sort of low down. And what you're doing is you're creating a rock structure that spins around in a spiral shape into the center where it raises up, and all those rocks will heat up, warming the soil and making it so that the soil is warmer earlier and warmer later in the season, mm-hmm. and gets that heat in areas where you don't necessarily have a lot of heat. So we did it as an herb spiral for the book. And I say we, because I worked with another group who built it, and I did the planting plan, but we had, you know, I had a wonderful group in from Harris Seeds in New York State that mm-hmm. have already built this. And I was there seeing it a couple of years ago. And so that's where we put the planting plan for the herbs in there. Mm-hmm. The idea is that it heats up the soil and it holds the heat a lot better. So drought tolerant things like succulents, like, you know, Mediterranean herbs, like, you know, things like lavender and rosemary and sages that like that sort of heat do really, mm-hmm. really well. And it helps to keep them perennial in areas that might not necessarily be perennial. It's just really changing the soil structure. I mean, a raised bed will do that as well. You know, we know mm-hmm, that raised mm-hmm. beds allow us to have a little different microclimate in our soil that heats it up a little bit, and things might bloom a little bit sooner, or they might fruit a little bit sooner. But it's the same when you do the spiral, you're creating a lot more linear planting space mm-hmm. in a smaller footprint.
Mm-hmm. There was, another word. I can't remember what it means. Guilds.
Oh, yes, guilds. So that's a very common permaculture term for something that, so for example, it's plants that work together to mm-hmm. create some sort of, so one of the things that we probably know more commonly is the indigenous concept of the three sisters. So
that's what it is.
Yeah. That's a guild that works together. I mean, it's a mini guild because there's only the three plants, but then there's Mexico, the indigenous concept of milpas, which is mm-hmm. not just the three sisters, but it's got, they have whole farms that are built on this concept of all these plants that grow together. So the three sisters is where you plant beans and squash and corn together. So the corn grows up in a big stalk. The beans, the pole beans, not bush beans, the pole beans will use the stalk to grow up while also fixing the nitrogen in the soil. And then the squash will grow down below, becoming shaded by the other plants and all of the, and being able to, you know, create mm-hmm. Sort of have a shallower root system and sprawl and keep the base of the other plants cool. So these three work together so that you get in one small footprint, three different kinds of plants that provide a lot of food. Mm-hmm. And so a guild, I have a bunch of guild recipes in the book where you, mm-hmm. would, you know, perhaps do something like you surround it around one apple tree. So you plant an apple tree, then you're planting a bunch of things like perennial plants. You could do food plants. You can do mm-hmm. medicinal plants. You can do pollinator friendly plants. Lots of great pollinator plants are great around apple trees because if they bloom early enough, then they're going to bring in those bees that will pollinate your apples and give you more fruit. So the idea is that they're all working together in a smaller space, just like I mentioned earlier, like the forest does, or like the meadow does. They don't just, you know, Mother Nature doesn't plant one kind of plant all in rows. She spreads mm-hmm. all different kinds of plants together so that they all support each other. You know, the more we learn about the forest and the more we learn about how plants are interconnected, we learn that, you know, a lone tree is a lonely tree. Mm-hmm. They have communication systems. They need to be close to each other. They have, you know, the mycelium network of communication and support and feeding the small saplings. So there's so much going on beneath the soil that if we're planting everything in rows, we have to replicate that. If we plant mm-hmm. things together in a guild, all those plants can support each other. And, you know, they've shown us videos of, you can see them on YouTube. You can see videos of what happens when you've walked away from a guild after 10 years and come back, that it's thriving and there's so much food being produced and yet nobody's tended to it for 10 years. So how is that even possible if how we're growing food requires so much of our efforts, right?
Absolutely. The, I wanted to mention in that section of the book, I guess it could have to do with my other hat, which is as an editor. I just love the layout of it. Something about these hexagons, you know, for that there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or something. And each one contains the information that you're looking for. And you do that in two sections. And I thought that was just so much more elegant than what I'm accustomed to. The other one was with companion planting, what plants to plant together. And it's so obvious. I don't know why I never thought of it, because I've set up these grids, plant this with this, don't plant that with this and all that. I just love the way that, that you're, I don't know, your designer or somebody did that. And it brings back the bees as well, the concept of the hive.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is my 11th book. So I love working with Cold Springs Press. They are such a great publisher.
They
this
do
is
the publish second, a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. And this is my second book with them. And they gave me a lot of freedom. I have a really great editor who had some great suggestions. Garden Alchemy was the book I did with them in 2020. And we had, and the editor had some really great ideas for, you know, why don't we do some cool page spreads that sort of break up sort of the information in the book and make it look artistic. Photography is one of my passions. And so I, you know, really spend a lot of time sort of making things look pretty. And so working together with them on that book, I had, and how it came together, it was so beautiful that, you know, the reviews that came in were like, Stephanie can make worm pope look pretty. Like, how is this possible? So I thought, okay, I really want to take this to a whole new level in the regenerative garden. I want to make it so pretty and aesthetically pleasing that people can see, you know, that this is meant to be joyful. It's meant to be approachable. It's meant to be something that, you know, gives you, puts a smile on your face. So as I was sitting there thinking about this book, one day I had this aha moment. And I typed it out to my editor and sent it to her. And she said, Stephanie, I read the first sentence that you had your aha moment. She says, I get this from authors all the time. And and I was a little bit worried. I'm going to be honest. I was a little bit worried because that aha moment is often something that it's just, oh dear. Okay. The author wants to go in this direction, but she said this is something that, that made a lot of sense. So for me, when I was sitting, writing out the chapters of the book and doing the outline and how I wanted to pull it together, I thought this is not a linear concept. It's circular. That each one of the projects attaches to each of the other projects' chapters. There's no, you know, there's no just one, you know, this, the hurdles is just in the climate chapter because it provides so many other reasonable supports to the other chapters, the water, the plants, the community aspect of it, all of this, ethics. So when I was putting all of this together, I thought, okay, it's got to be circular. And so when I photographed the cover, if you see the cover of the book, it's plants that are in a rainbow all around in a circle.
Okay.
Plus we have that little honeycomb on the cover as well, telling us that it's a home scale permaculture book. Mm-hmm. And so what we did is took that honeycomb concept and brought it throughout the book. So when it's good, better, and best, it's one honeycomb is good, two honeycombs is better, and three honeycombs is best. And as we've designed the book, the idea is that it all knits together as nature would. So it's not a linear concept. You can open up the book at sort of any chapter and start there and pick out the projects that work for you and close it and pick up another chapter another day. So thank you for noticing that, because actually a lot of thought went into that. And I think that when people read, they enjoy that there's more to it than just, you know, dumping information onto pages, that we take the time to try to teach in a way that's not just the words that you read or the pictures that you see, mm-hmm. but how it's put together has a great deal to do with how we learn and absorb information. And it's the same in our gardens. Mm-hmm. It's making it so easy that it makes a lot more sense when we step out into our garden and it's designed a certain way.
This is awesome. Okay, we're going to take another quick break and we'll be back in just a moment.
It's hard to believe spring is actually here. Are you ready to garden? Is your garden ready for you? Learn more when you subscribe to Canada's Local Gardener magazine. Come and grow with us.
Back. I'm here with Stephanie Rose, and we're talking about The Regenerative Garden, her book that came out just on March 15th.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. We just had the launch, and I had snuck away. I'll say, like, I've been working on this book for a long time, and mm-hmm. and we did 3 months or 3 or 4 months of like pre-launch. I had, you know, like a whole bunch of encouragement for pre-orders. Pre-orders is super important for books. So if you like an author or you're like a concept mm-hmm. of a book, please pre-order it, because it really helps tell those big bookstores to get those books out there. And, you know, the more we can get this kind of information out there, the better. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I took a little ski vacation and actually went away for spring break with my son. And then the book launched and I sat there on the mountain going, this is the opposite of what I felt like I would be doing on the launch. Mm-hmm. But it was so nice and so warming, because I saw all these people on Instagram showing their copies of the book that they had already pre-ordered and how mm-hmm. much they were enjoying it. And the reviews started coming in. So yeah, super, super exciting time right now. I'm so thrilled that people are open and excited about this concept of regenerative gardening.
For sure. I wanted to ask you, I didn't have a chance to read deeply into this, so maybe you already answered it in the book, but you talk about compost, and of course you want to make your own, but when you have to order it, why do you recommend mixing your own compost with the compost that you've bought before putting it on the garden?
So yeah, I've done a lot of research and thinking about this concept of compost. And so often I just think about the path. So I'm going to answer your question by talking through the path mm-hmm. a little bit. So we take all this plant material from our gardens and our kitchen waste and our you know, carbon sources and all that sort of thing, and we put it into our green bins and we send it away. Mm-hmm. And so if we have a city composting system, that's great, because the city will compost it and send it back. And then we've got to then repurchase everybody's sort of mix of compost and who knows what they put in it, those biodegradable bags. I'm using air quotes. You can't see them right, because we're on a podcast, mm-hmm. but you know, these sorts of things, we don't really know what's going into pesticides, diseases, you know, or herbicides, junk, whatever, tons and tons of plastic, all that stuff is going into that city compost, and then we're buying it back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the place, it's, first of all, it's super wasteful. So in the ethics chapter is where I talk a little bit more about compost. It's about reducing waste. It's about not taking that beautiful, great, wonderful stuff that we have and sending mm-hmm. it away and having somebody else compost it. And trying to do it on our property. The other thing is the concept of looking at of compost as being hyper local. Mm-hmm. So in our gardens, we're producing the kinds of microorganisms and bacteria and fungi and all these things that have helped our particular gardens to thrive. Mm-hmm. And if we send it away and we bring somebody else's in, then we don't really know if those organisms are going to thrive in our garden. If we're creating our own compost, then we're allowing those microorganisms to continue to live on our property mm-hmm. and go back into our soil.
Oh, for sure.
So go ahead.
Yep. Oh, no, you go ahead.
Well, to answer the question about why I would mix in some of my own compost compost that I've brought in is that if I don't have enough compost, and how can we ever have enough compost? I mean, it's really tough. When I do bring in compost, I find that it's still usually in the composting cycle. It's very, very smelly. It has a strong, like, it doesn't have that sweet finished compost smell, but it can also be steaming and still doing its compost work. Mm-hmm. I typically spread that out and then add my own compost in. So first spread it out, let it cool down and settle down. Mm-hmm. And then once, because if you put that right on the garden, it's just going to, you know, not do great things for your plants. It's going to burn them. So spread that out and then add in some of your compost. And if you can leave that for a little bit of time, then you're allowing those microorganisms to hopefully integrate with that other compost before spreading it out in the garden, or at least getting as much of your microorganisms out there building mm-hmm. so that you're not sort of automatically smothering them.
Right.
So that's sort of the thought process in it. It's not a, you know, it's an idea. It's mm-hmm. not something that you have to do, but it's thinking through how do we keep our compost local? How do we keep, understand that what we have below our soil is wildlife. So mm-hmm. I call it soil wildlife. And we want, it's just like below the ocean. There's so much going on both in the ocean, especially deep down, that we don't really know about.
Right.
And the less we can disturb that, the better. Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. So much to talk about in your book, but I do want to touch on something. And that is the bit about community that you mentioned. Do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely. This is when people ask what my favorite part of the book is, it's always really hard to figure out what it is. But the six chapters are, we start with soil, of course, mm-hmm. then there's plants, there's water, there's climate, ethics, and then community. And so it kind of seemed like a funny thing to do in a project book to have, you know, the plants, water, and soil, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. When we get to climate, it's like, okay, well, I explained what that was in this podcast, so it makes a little bit more sense. And then I just explained the ethics, where we're reducing waste and using things the best that we can so that we're not putting in that effort and we're, you know, getting that concept of keeping everything hyper-local as much as we can. Mm-hmm. But community was a chapter that I was going to call wildlife. It makes a lot of sense because in a regenerative garden, we want to use our literal worker bees to do our pollination for us. We want to invite wildlife in order to mm-hmm. do pest control, you know, and help sort of move things around for us, clean up our debris. But as I thought about it, I thought, you know, there's so much more life that is invited into our garden than simply the wildlife. Mm-hmm. And it's how our garden becomes a hub or a space for our families, mm-hmm. for our neighbors, for our friends, for the people who pass by, mm-hmm. and how it can help to intersect with our communities. So the projects in that chapter have to do with wildlife. And you mm-hmm. saw my wildlife pond when you came, and some of the,
yep.
when mm-hmm. you came to visit the garden, you took some pictures and put that in the magazine, which was so lovely. Mm-hmm. But I also have projects in there about how we can reach out to our communities. This has become such an important thing as we are, you know, as we've gone through 2 years of a pandemic and we've mm-hmm. been, you know, sort of, I don't want to say stuck in our houses, but, you know, almost given the gift of having to focus on our communities rather than jumping on planes and flying and traveling all over the place. Mm-hmm. So I've noticed just in my immediate neighborhood, how much of a change there has been for people reaching out to those in their neighborhoods and taking so much pride in that. So an example is seed libraries. Mm-hmm. So a seed library is like a little free library that people have for books, and you can see them sort of all around urban centers and some, you know, suburban or even some rural areas will have little book libraries like that. Mm-hmm. But it's for seed sharing. And in my East Vancouver neighborhood, there's no less than 8 of them and a Google Map, so you can see them all. Yeah, absolutely. Because there's such a value here of community sharing and also gardening. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that there's all these little seed libraries out where people can collect and share seeds, they can gather seeds. If, you know, they have extras, they can put their half pack in there and mm-hmm. somebody else can take them away. I mean, think of all the seedy Saturdays that we go to and community community sharing. This is a way to just have it, you know, something set up on your front step. But it might also encourage children to come through and pick out some seeds that they want to grow and bring them home to their parents. There's the beauty of sharing information as well. So these can also have books on gardening. There could be, you know, if the owners of the, or the sort of managers of the seed library put in information about how to start seeds, you know, maybe some seed potting mixes, if they started too many seeds, adding in starts. Mm-hmm. It's just this like wonderful concept of bringing community sharing to our neighborhood.
So that's that whole...
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
It's a great idea. Just recently, Mr. Fothergill's, you know, the seed company, it's, I think it's English, British based, and they've always sold in Canada, as far as I know, but they're trying to get more sales in Canada. So they sent out some seed packages. Well, there must have been, how many in that, Mum? How many were in your seed package that you got from Fothergill's?
I don't know, there were probably 50 or 60
different varieties.
I've been sharing them with everybody.
I don't even know what to do with them all.
Share them.
Yeah. So maybe what we need, though, is one of these little seed libraries.
Oh, that would be so wonderful for you to have that. I mean, that's the thing, is that I'm also blessed with, you know, the opportunity to get a lot of seeds sent to me. Mm-hmm. And so I go through and usually put them in the, usually was setting them up in the little free libraries, and they would go, I would go and check, mm-hmm. you know, within a couple of hours, and those seeds were all gone. So I really love this idea. So I had, you know, some ideas for how you can build your own and some concepts. There's a really fun one. I didn't put it in the book, but really fun that Doug Oster is doing. That is he got the old newspaper vending things mm-hmm. and has turned those into seed libraries, which mm-hmm. is super cool. But so in this book, I have in the community chapter, a whole bunch of things that reach out to our neighbors. So there's seed libraries, there's an urban flower stand, it's urban farm stand, different projects, growing children friendly plants in your front yard. So you can invite your neighborhood children to sort of fall in love with gardening. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that if children fall in love with gardening, then they'll grow up to protect the earth. So, you know, the more we can sort of delight and inspire them this way, the better we'll be at, you know, helping them find and foster that joy for our earth as they grow older.
For sure. And between you and me, we both live in central urban areas, and that's something you can do. Now at Mum's place, you know, it's people do walk down the street, but I guess you'd get maybe 10 in a day maximum. And you and I probably get 50, 60, 80 per day, people just walking by the house. So that's just wonderful. My goodness, we've had a great talk today. There's so much more I'm sure you could tell me. You're a great guest, because I ask a question and you just bring so much more to it than I ever asked. It's wonderful.
That's a kind way of saying I talk a lot about plants. But yes, I've never had a problem speaking about plants.
That's fantastic. I want to thank you for being here today, and Mum, of course, as well. I need to thank the Government of Canada for giving us the money to make this possible. And Stephanie, I hope we can talk again soon.
I would absolutely love that, Shauna. And Dorothy, thank you so much for having me again today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye.